Wyoming Catholic College Associate Professor of Fine Arts and Humanities, Dr. Jason Baxter, begins his new book on the humanities by reminiscing about the summer of 2016. During the summer, he and his family lived on Ischia, a beautiful island in Italy's Bay of Naples. "I begin this book on the humanities," he writes, "with a description of travel because I think the experience of being immersed in a world of surprises, like I was in Ischia, and the experience of reading a great book is fundamentally analogous." This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, your host for these After Dinner Scholar podcasts. Dr. Baxter goes on to write that his book, Falling Inward, Humanities in the Age of Technology, is an answer to the question, how is the profound sense of travel like the experience of reading? Both, he says, are fundamentally the same experience that he calls falling inward. To discuss his book and the meaning of the title, Falling Inward, Dr. Baxter is our guest on this week's After Dinner Scholar. Dr. Baxter, begin by telling us about Falling Inward. What's the book about, and what do you hope the book will accomplish?
The book is about the reading experience that occurs when reading great books in the liberal arts tradition. It's about how to do it, how to read that way, as well as it's particularly interested in, I guess you could say, what that experience feels like, what you discover in the midst of reading great literature. And it's particularly interested in what the great books or the liberal arts or certain a Homer or a Plato or a Dante or a Lewis can do in particular that can't be done in a technological age.
When you and I spoke on a podcast about Gothic architecture, you used the phrase falling inward. Now you're using it not just to describe architecture, though I noticed there is a chapter on architecture, but the experience of reading great literature. What do you mean by falling inward, and how does great literature bring about that experience?
Plato describes this in his dialogue with Phaedrus. And as they're having a conversation about what kinds of speeches are effective, what kind of speeches move people, they give us a series of speeches, some of which are better than others. But then Socrates gives this extraordinary speech in which the myth of the charioteer is found, and which it says the reason that, say, falling in love is such an exciting and tingling experience is because it's ultimately related to returning home, to your truest self, to meaning itself, to what Plato was trying to say, God. But the fascinating thing about this dialogue is that's ordinarily where we stop reading. Whereas in the second half of the dialogue, it gets really difficult and arid and dialectical and logical as they begin to ask what are the essential logical and elemental components which make a speech effective. And thus they begin sort of reasoning their way up to increasingly abstract principles until they come to that which has no origin, the good itself or being itself. So it seems to me that in a way, a lot of these books create an opportunity to create a sense of falling inward, analogous to what Plato describes in the Phaedrus of the charioteer ascending. It's a way of experiencing truth, not necessarily analyzing it for a logical way, but experiencing it as beauty and as goodness. And it invokes a similar sensation, say, to great works of art like a Gothic cathedral, an experience of wonder, an experience of awe, an experience of desire to be full, to live in fullness, to have a complete happiness which goes all the way to the inner core of your human being.
One of the chapters is entitled, Why Read Old Books? Rediscovering the Buried Past. In outline, what's your argument for reading old books? Why old books?
You can read old books for a number of reasons, but I have borrowed the title from an article by Lewis, Learning During Wartime, in which he says that he knows that everyone's most pressing question is, why should I do anything but aid in the war effort? Why should I do something that would almost seem absurd in the situation in which soldiers from my country are dying in foreign lands and Germans are bombing citizens? Why? How could you possibly possibly go to Oxford and study sound laws of Anglo-Saxon or some sort of obscure poetic or philosophical knowledge. And that's what I was thinking. Analogously, living in our world, the most common question that students, my students, receive is, why would you waste your time with the liberal arts? Why not do something which is an immediate preparation? And so in this essay, I try to address a couple of aspects. One of them is that reading old books, especially pre-modern books, which is what I mean by old books, roughly books written before 1500, so classical antiquity, Greece, Rome, as well as the Christian Middle Ages, reintroduces us to certain concepts which used to be fundamental and essential to, well, the Christian religion as well as all of experience. There are whole modes of, say, experiencing God or the divine which have evaporated. I mean, the sociologist Christian Smith at Notre Dame likes to say that all young people, by default, religious young people, are moralistic therapeutic deists, by which he means we all have a certain mentality of approaching God, which, if I am good, he will reward me with things I want. We'll come to find out, if you read old books, this is not the way in which ancients would think about divinity, or think about God, or think about glory. They have completely different concepts which have been fundamental to medieval Christianity, to ancient Christianity, well, to all of Christianity, as well as all pre-modern religion, which have evaporated in the modern age. So, among other things, to reintroduce yourself to certain conceptions, certain ways of viewing the world, can open your eyes to how flattened out and shallow our own modern conceptions are, all of which we inherit by default, unless we do something about it.
And certainly reading old books is one way to do something about it.
Absolutely.
C.S. Lewis argued something similar in an essay, I think, called On Reading Old Books, or something like that. And he said, for every one modern book we read, we ought to read three old ones.
I think that's probably a good proportion, yes. Yeah.
In the chapter, Globalism, Technology, and Poetry, you remark, the humanities, like some old prophet from the desert, reminds us of our creaturehood. How so?
I think in a world of technology and modern science and instant communication and power over almost everything in my surroundings, it's easy to get annoyed at the slightest introduction to limitations to my desire. I get in traffic and it takes me 35 minutes to get home instead of 15. My electricity isn't working today. My ability to purchase food instantly and easily and cheaply is limited. Gas prices are up by 30%. We have such an extraordinary technological command over our immediate environment that I think it's given us a mentality which probably has never existed before, in which we see the world as being at hand for us, as creatures waiting for us to eat them or, you know, use them for our own pleasure. We've lost a sense that we are one creature among many in a world which is, if I may, giftedness, in which we do have the privilege of interacting, but which was not primarily made for us. It was made because it was beautiful, and we are given the privilege to dwell within it. I think old books, in particular, give that tremendous sense of creaturehood, as well as those who read old books and in some sense gave a rebirth to them. I think in that particular passage, I was thinking about T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets, mm-hmm. and in particular part where he talks about the river, which once was a god worshipped, but then became, just as he says, a problem for the engineer. A bridge is built over it. And I know this feeling, growing up in Little Rock, Arkansas, driving over the river and just ignoring it because we have these enormous bridges. So we don't sense the power of the world we live in. We don't sense our own fragility, our own creaturehood. Although I think technological advances are precious gifts and good, and I'm grateful for them, they can lead to, I think, a sort of a dangerously limited psychological experience of the world, in which I begin to forget my own fragility I begin to assume my own power, and most devastatingly, I begin to fail to let other things be independently of my will.
You mentioned bridges, and it always astounds me that driving over the George Washington Bridge from New Jersey into Manhattan, the bridge is constructed in such a way that you can see the buildings. You can see what human beings have made, but you can't see the water because there's at least a railing that's blocking your view of the water. And how strange that is. The river doesn't matter. It's just a barrier. It's just as Eliot said, it's a problem for engineers.
I think it's interesting. Well, I mean, just like with old books, old cities have a greater harmonious integration with their natural environments. They, I mean, we now have the privilege, again, because of our technological abilities, to create cities out of artificial substances which can be created on site or imported from anywhere. What that means is that our built structures and our natural structures no longer have the relationship, say, as they would in historical places. Tuscany, you'll find things built with stone and baked clay. In the Cotswold region in England, you find another type of stone used, and there's a greater sort of integration. I think the ancients saw this well. They saw that man had a rational capacity, as if he could find the inner principles of nature and perfect them. The analogy used is that nature is sort of groaning to speak a hymn which he doesn't have words for, and man can provide those words. Whereas a contemporary environmentalist position would see man as a mere blight on nature. But that's because we've lost the ability to see man as working within natural bounds and perfecting what's already been there, as opposed to just importing things from elsewhere.
You warn in the last chapter about consuming great books, just sitting down and just sort of chewing through them, rather than sitting with them with a pure heart. Explain the distinction you're making, and how do we read the great text, or how do we read any text, with a pure heart?
I think I was probably thinking more about the distinction between the rapid consumption of information, the sort of intellectual gluttony that Nicholas Carr has described in his technological works, which I reference frequently throughout the book, in which, because of our smartphones and because of our internet browsing strategies, we supposedly, on average, we only spend 7 seconds on a web page before browsing to a new one. So for us, a deep, long read is 25 minutes. And Nicholas Carr points out that we seemingly are experiencing intellectual fatigue, growing tired in the mind after a mere, say, 15 to 20 minute reading session. I've certainly seen that. I think increasingly, even though I've only taught for about 10 years, I've seen it. My students, I think, reach a level of intellectual fatigue much earlier than they used to. So in that world in which we want to consume information as quickly as possible, it's extremely different from an older mentality of the Middle Ages, mentality of the Lectio Divina, or trying to develop the ability to read with puritas cordis, which first of all involves a state of tranquility, the ability to give mental or to exercise mental discipline, to attend to something closely. But it also involves the expectation that what you read, you will remember. It sounds almost banal to say it, but say going into a college classroom, many of my students, and they're very, very good students, will report to me that they've read the assignment. But I've discovered what they mean by that is they've looked at all of the words in order. And when an argument became a little bit obscure, a little bit difficult, oftentimes they'll just keep on reading through it. So a lot of times we as modern readers don't expect ourselves to understand the difficult bits. We just begin skimming, our eyes glaze over the words, and we continue moving on till we find something again that we like and understand. But what if you slowed down, read every single paragraph, tried to see down into its essence, thought about it, asked if it were attractive, then why? And then by the time you got to the end of the reading, you put your finger in a book and closed it, and demanded of yourself the ability to reconstruct the plot or the flow of the argument, as well as the images and the individual arguments used, from memory. That, I think, is what the ancients would require as a bare minimum before you could even begin to do a deep reading. But once you have a map of the text in your mind, you can see the arguments or the plots and the characters, then you can begin asking deep questions. Why questions? Why was this image used as opposed to this? Or why was this argument seemingly so successful within the Platonic dialogue? And that's what I suggest in my book. That's when the real experience of falling inward begins. Because the mere sort of cognitive map of the arguments begins to yield into an internal possession by which I'm capable of beginning to wonder at the depth and the profundity of certain things. Not just that I know what an author said, but I begin to realize how much it resonates as true.
Writing in the Newman Society Journal, Wyoming Catholic College alumna Veronica Arnst observes that a liberal arts education, quote, allows a person the space to wonder and to contemplate, to consider the goodness of the world and of existence, close quote. And of course, that kind of education need not, should not, end with college graduation. The liberal arts are for everybody. One way to jumpstart your thinking about your ongoing education is to get and read Jason Baxter's new book, Falling Inward, Humanities in the Age of Technology. Another way to jump in is to attend the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought this June 10th to 14th here in Lander, Wyoming. We'll rediscover the buried past with authors including Homer, Plato, Aristotle, Thomas Aquinas, George Washington, and Romano Guardini as we consider the paradox of courage. For more information, visit us at wyomingcatholic.org. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.